Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. Hi, welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. We are talking in this episode all about hospice, and I'm excited to be able to introduce you to Samantha Gambale, who is one of the therapists here at the Center for Grief and Trauma Therapy, coming from a background of working in hospice. And I'm just no one better to introduce herself to you guys than her herself. So I'm going to turn this over and say, hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate
it. It's such a topic that nobody wants to talk about.
I'm super excited.
Cool. Tell us a little bit about you and your background. How did you end up in hospice? Well, not you in hospice, but how did your career end up in hospice? And then and tell us a little bit about you.
So when I was an undergrad, I got into the field of social work through an experience of witnessing someone at a very young age go through cirrhosis of the liver and navigating the transplant list, the hospital systems, not really having a support in place. I recognized how healthcare is lacking. And then once we entered the hospice world, I then found that there's this like multidisciplinary team that can address the deficits that I feel like most healthcare providers don't do for our everyday life, except I feel like at our center.
We try here,
yeah. Which is what I love about the center. So I have been working in hospice for 6 years. I did undergrad internship under the bereavement coordinator, which is essentially following up with all the families that have had a loved one pass on our service, and we follow up with them for 13 months. However, we also do pre-bereavement, which is to help them cope prior to that, which we'll touch on later.
Okay.
So essentially, I came to this path of the center because my background in hospice aligning with the philosophy that we should provide spiritual, holistic, therapeutic support, not just at end of life. This is where I ended up here. So I hope I explained it a little bit.
No, you did great. No, you did great. That's how you ended up here. And I'm so excited to know more about like kind of parsing apart and deconstructing, because we talk about in this podcast, deconstructing the myths around grief, but also reconstructing somebody's understanding of themselves in the world and their narrative, but with maybe with more information than they had before, so that they know what they're actually wrapping their heads around. So talking about hospice is such an area that people just do not want to talk about, because they hear hospice and they think death, and then you end up like with professionals like you and me, where, I end up doing a presentation on prolonged grief disorder and family caregivers, and they were standing room only. And yet this is a topic nobody wants to talk about. You know what I mean? So obviously it's hitting a lot of people, and I have people emailing me after going, thank you so much for being willing to talk about it, because I can't even get the people in my life to talk about this stuff. So I knew immediately that it had to be a topic that we touched on in the podcast. And there, I think there'll be multiple times we'll have to readdress some of the things that come up, the nuances that come up.
Well, you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's a death avoidant culture, which is part of like what we're trying to change the narrative with hospice, because many people choose to view hospice as like the very end of life. Last few days, they're actively dying, actively transitioning, when it's actually supposed to be, I mean, this prognosis of 6 months or less, however many people recertified for additional. So people, when they're coming on at the very end of their life, don't get the full hospice benefit. And the full hospice benefit is to not only meet the needs of the patient, but the family. So we have an RN case manager.
A nurse.
Okay.
No, that's nurse, okay. Yeah. I just want to make sure
we're clear. Which is like the point person. They're coming in based on the patient's need to, administer like medication, the plan of care, just really guiding the family along through the end of life journey. In addition to that, we also have spiritual support, okay, which is to address the end of life spiritual needs, which people don't often think about because I think
it can be talking religious, spiritual, both?
So they come both. Like, okay, so if someone is, for instance, Catholic, like we used to have a father, but he would still, you know, go to like Christian, other, they're supposed to meet you where you're at. That's the whole goal. So it's okay, not, we're not coming at you like we had a rabbi, we had a father. We're not coming at you with our religious beliefs, but rather meeting you where you're at.
Okay.
And to also meet the family and help them through their spiritual needs. Because sometimes you have instances where the patient has a different belief, religion versus what their loved ones have.
Right.
And navigating that. So we have spiritual support. On top of that, we also have a social worker, which is, you know, key to navigating like respite care, psychoeducation, providing support and counseling to the family.
What's respite care?
Okay. So respite care is provided by hospice that if you have caregiver burnout, which is very frequently. We'll touch on later. That you're provided 5 days paid by hospice to have in a skilled nursing facility for the patient to be there so that you can take whatever you need to recharge, whether it's you have something to do or you just need a break.
So wait. Let me see if I got this. This is, so you'll get paid by the hospice to be able to step away and they'll be taken care of by the hospice organization so you can go and take care of yourself?
So hospice is 100% covered under the Medicare benefit.
Right.
Okay. So even the respite is, and the transport. Another thing people don't realize is that like if you fall, you can call 911. That doesn't mean that they're going to be sent to the hospital. They can just help assist, get them up. Like certain things to help caregivers in place. Another, I don't want to forget about the rest of the team. Sorry, before I go.
No, don't. Yeah. I'll bring it back. I was going to bring it back, but no, yeah. Okay. So we've got spiritual care, mm-hmm, meeting the clients and mm-hmm the family where they're mm-hmm at. We've got a bereavement coordinator. Mm-hmm. We've got the nurse kind of point person. Mm-hmm. We've got the social worker who is mm-hmm doing what?
So the social worker would be setting up the transport, respite care. If anything happens needs-wise, safety plans, like the social worker can also provide like a counseling role as well.
Okay.
Because the goal, again, is to meet the end of life needs for the patient and the family, because they will be absolutely in conjunction. And many people don't realize this, that hospice is also not just meant for the patient, but to also help the families navigate, because this is such a difficult time. And what better than to have an extra set of services that can help you through this? So mm-hmm we also have volunteers, which would include sometimes pet therapy. They would come in, meet with, you know, I've seen some really cool stuff with a meeting with the patients, mm-hmm, music therapy, amazing with those that have dementia and just like touching in. I've seen them be able to do kind of like a life narrative that through music therapy, they leave behind a legacy, like legacy making, like what would their song be? And then being a bereavement coordinator, giving that to the family after they passed
to listen to it. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So we try to work through these end of life needs because, can I be honest?
I hope so. That's the cool thing about having your own podcast. You can say whatever the heck you want, but be honest.
So being in hospice for as long as I have, I've borne witness to people not having psychosocial needs met at the end of their life. And what does death look like when you don't have that met mm-hmm versus when you do? My first internship day, like experience, I went out in the field. And they sent me to sit bedside, which is part of what volunteers, interns do. If you don't have somebody bedside, we will sit bedside. That's part of our role. We want to support the family. However, this individual had none of her psychosocial needs met. She didn't have family support. She was very scared. Her biggest fear was dying alone. I went in as a volunteer. I was the only person present with her while she was dying.
Oh my God.
She grabbed me, screamed, "Help, help me." And, you know, back then I was like 20, 21. And I will never forget being like petrified of like, what is going on? And later I found out all of these unmet needs that had occurred. She died within 10 minutes of that. Like,
oh my God.
Yeah. So that was like, she had terminal restlessness, like couldn't, she would not even get out of bed and then just pass in this very anxious state. Same day.
That is heart-wrenching to hear that.
Oh, yes, it was. It was one of those things you're like in the shower, like,
why the hell do I want to do this?
Yeah.
What
did I just see?
Yeah.
Like, right. However, I had the benefit in the same day of going to see a family patient that was also actively dying, that had family support, had a lot of team support, and she was so peaceful. And it was such a stark contrast of just peacefully. She died within 10 minutes too. So like to see the comparison and to go back and understand, because I had to do a lot of processing with what I had seen, because death, a bad death can be very traumatic. And I think that a lot of people can relate to that experience, seeing your loved one, feeling that helplessness. Mm-hmm. And processing that. And so recognizing that unmet psychosocial needs really do have an impact in the way we die.
Oh, yeah.
So I just.
And so we hear people talk about a good death, and you're like, what do you mean a good death? But there is our components of what is considered a good death. And you just kind of touched upon that. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can come back to that too. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost like they're conflicting mm-hmm. words, mm-hmm. good and death. But why does, and mm-hmm. there's bad, and then there's death. Mm-hmm. And most people are like, death is bad, you know? And, mm-hmm. and now that's not a statistic, and I don't know where I got most people and all that other stuff, but from all of the conversations I've had mm-hmm. in my life, I don't think I've had a lot of people say, oh, it was a good death. Mm-hmm. But you do hear things like, she had everybody around her, she had her loved ones, she looked like she was at peace, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. But then you end up hearing about other ones of family members that are like, wait a minute, why is she picking at her clothes? Mm-hmm. And why is she seeing people on the other side of the room? Mm-hmm. And she's not eating. Don't we want to make sure she's eating? And she's not drinking. And so not even understanding what dying can look like, mm-hmm. which maybe that's a whole new episode. That might be a whole new episode.
Well,
what does dying look like?
I'm smiling just simply because those are questions. That's what we guide. Like, we try to explain, like, as your body is shutting down, you don't need fluids. You don't need the food. That's more of a cultural thing. We feel like we have to feed, but their body
especially
can't
if you're
do
Italian.
It.
Just saying.
It goes
against every single bone in my body. And like, we're supposed to eat and feed you whether or not you're hungry or not.
So people will do that.
We will. sneaking in a biscuit. There you go.
But it's hard to accept because you're watching, you want to control it. And of you course. Can't. And their body is shutting down for a reason. So many people have fear and apprehension of some of the medications like morphine, Ativan, when really the goal is just to create the comfort. Because if you don't address the pain or certain things that can be agitators, even like, for instance, morphine is a misconception that that's going to speed and hasten death. It actually helps with breathing process so that they can breathe easier. There's a lot of secretions that tend to be like at the end of life. Like, we can go into the whole dying process.
Yeah.
But we're there to educate and explain, this is what's going on with the body. And because people don't see death. Like we said, it's a death avoidance.
So you're surrounded by your loved ones. Mm-hmm. You're dying. And you've got somebody there who's gracious enough to be able to say, what's going on right now is that, you know, this is normal. And I know there's handouts and stuff that they're mm-hmm. often given, mm-hmm. you know, psychoeducational materials mm-hmm. that say, don't be surprised if you see this kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. it doesn't mean you're definitely going to see mm-hmm. that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I know I've seen some people have been almost traumatized by their experience. And other people have been like, I am so glad I was there mm-hmm. the whole time. Mm-hmm. So having somebody like you in the room, being able to educate along the way, or, you know, or before they go in, or mm-hmm. here, you might be seeing this when you walk in the room. You know, I just want you to be aware. Mm-hmm. Is that what your role would have been?
So if they're pre-bereavement, for my role as a bereavement coordinator, typically I would follow up after the patient has passed to provide
support.
Is that
support. What you mean by pre-bereavement?
So
because I think of yes. anticipatory grief, like they know their loved one. That's a whole different.
So it is like that anticipatory yeah. grief. So yeah. pre-bereavement is typically we... as bereavement coordinators go in when there's like a higher acuity, in the sense that like there's issues adjusting. I don't know if issues is the right word, but difficulties adjusting to this end of life process,
yeah,
pain,
yeah.
and trying to help them understand what's going on with the body. And that sometimes people will try to have someone who's actively dying meet their needs and the caregiver's needs to get something from them. And having to explain a dying person can't do that. And just like meeting them where they're at to guide them through this process mm-hmm. of what death looks like. And then the grief afterwards, because the anticipatory grief is that limbo. Mm-hmm. When are they going to die? How long am I going to be here? Am I going to need FMLA? Am I going to run out of FMLA? What happens if I do? Like, it's just this whole extra layer of stress that people have to come to. And that's where the respite care, I circle back to hospice, we try to implement because we don't want our families, our caregivers to burn out. We're trying the best we can to support them through that. Sometimes it's even if they're in the home and we evaluate the home is like not the best place to be, we're going to help them take the next steps to get either, you know, in-home care or if they need to go to a facility, whatever's mm-hmm. safest so that we can make sure that the patient and the family are best supported because sometimes it's too much at home. There's a reason skilled nursing facilities exist.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, it's a lot of work. And as you mentioned, the traumatization, sometimes seeing your loved one being helpless, it's just not a good situation. I use the analogy of like, when we see these certain things, it's like there's a record and that's their life. And then once we see their death, it can be so traumatic. That's a scratch. And then it keeps repeating, right? Over that scratch rather than hearing the whole song.
Right.
So my goal as a bereavement coordinator, if I see pre-bereavement, like they're struggling with meaning making of why are they dying? They could even be 100 years old and I still can be in there hands-on trying to make meaning of this. So just trying to like circle back and just help them meet that psychosocial need also for the family. So
I wonder, are there different psychosocial needs for people mm-hmm. who have a loved one who is dying that is young outside of what we would call the normal trajectory, mm-hmm. you know, in our mm-hmm. culture that has a lot mm-hmm. of expectations that everybody's going to die mm-hmm. in succession based on age, right? So if we have a child who is very ill and has, you know, been, like we spoke yesterday, Christy, our coach mm-hmm. here, she lost her 15-year-old son and he was born a floppy baby, she called him. I know, right? Just for people who are listening, just so they know, you just made the confused face, which is literally the exact same face that I made yesterday of like floppy baby. What do you mean? Like when he was born, you know, when he's held, there was no like, the, you know, usually babies are like engaging physically mm-hmm. In their environment and he just was slumped. Mm-hmm. So he went into like, he, you know, ICU for 4 months. And throughout his entire life, he was in a wheelchair. And, but she always knew that he was going to die. So he died when he was 15. And we talked a lot about, you know, just nobody, like what it must be like for a parent to watch her 15-year-old child die mm-hmm. when, even though you've expected it, it's still when it's happening, it's still, and that's why I think people get like a little like, just because you knew it was coming doesn't mean it's going to be easier.
Exactly.
You know, there's anticipatory grief and then there's the grieving process that occurs afterwards.
Exactly.
And it's a continuum. They are related to each other, mm-hmm. but there are different feelings that can emerge pre-loss and post-loss. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that maybe, I don't know, when we get to talk about the caregiver, whenever, I don't know, each one of these two podcasts that we got going on. So I'm going to go back to the question mm-hmm. since I'm having my little squirrel moment where I've got so many questions about hospice. Did you notice that when a person was dying who was younger and not, let's say, 95, 100 years old, mm-hmm. is there a difference in the work that you had to do as a bereavement coordinator?
So there's two different types of hospice where they do more like palliative from, you know, like infancy all the way to like 21. The youngest I've had is 22. I will be honest that the family did not take advantage of the services and I can't speak to why, but I think it can be very difficult to just embrace that, your child is dying like at such a young age, unfulfilled dreams, that sometimes it can be hard to let the support in as well. Does that make sense? So we do have child hospices. They're much more, not child, pediatric. They're much higher acuity compared to like what we would do with geriatrics. Like if we knew a 22 like year old was coming on service at, or even people in their 40s, like we automatically have them on our radar. I know for pre-bereavement, there's typically children involved, other children, mm-hmm. you know, to be involved. So what that would look like is processing with them and getting them in touch with any other resources they may need through that process. But they have a separate pediatric versus, I don't want to say geriatric because we can do younger. And the way pediatric hospice
is, pediatric, maybe adult and then geriatric.
Yeah, but we do adults like too. Weird,
right, right.
It's like the spectrum. So geriatric will only do until like 21, maybe 22, like zero, like birth, right?
Or even before. Not geriatric.
Pediatric. Okay, let me repeat that. So pediatric okay. And even like mothers coming in to deliver stillborn. Mm-hmm. That's where there's a hospice realm for that all the way through until the child is 21 or 22.
So that's all considered pediatric.
Yes.
And that's interesting you mentioned like even stillbirth because we had an earlier episode and it's already been released. So if you're interested in knowing more about this, but we've got Kate Suarez who was a stillbirth doula mm-hmm. over. So she had that experience. Mm-hmm. So she would have been involved in this whole hospice mm-hmm. conversation. Mm-hmm. Would she mm-hmm. have been part of that? Like,
so, I mean, I would imagine I can't speak to like how they approached it with like yeah. Kate, the doula, but like in my eyes, this is another layer of support that
it would
probably,
think, yeah.
they probably would incorporate. I can't guarantee it, but should be.
It right? should be. Well, if you're talking even as early as that,
yeah.
at least maybe it would have been. I mean, they're so rare, you know, what she did. But all right, so you didn't work in with that population.
Not too much.
And you called it palliative care. You didn't call it hospice. Yeah. Well, now that's interesting. Yes.
So with the younger population, there is the term palliative care that they use rather than hospice care.
Why?
It's actually due to exactly what you're talking about, the death avoidant culture, the fear of what does hospice mean? Like we've even had people that are older, families don't want them to know they're on hospice care, the patient themselves. With children, palliative care is like a softer way of embracing that this is like comfort care for their terminal illness and that they will die.
Is There's that the difference between palliative care and hospice? What's the difference between
So when you get to the older population, palliative is its own separate entity where it's not a terminal diagnosis. You're just helping with symptom management, planning, like kind of getting people out of the acute crisis situation and managing their chronic condition and what that looks like. Yet child or pediatric palliative is more like comfort care for ultimately end of life.
So this is basically a form of death denial.
Yeah.
Let's call it out. I mean, it is like a form mm-hmm. of like wanting to avoid saying, yeah, you're on hospice mm-hmm. and your child is dying. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be.
Yeah.
You should have seen me yesterday. Like my friend was talking about, you know, loss of her child. I'm over here trying not to cry as she's talking, you know, and it's heart-wrenching. And I've worked with families who have lost their children that way. So I'm not trying to be calloused, mm-hmm. but I mean, if we're in this culture, not all cultures are like this. Mm-hmm. Not all mm-hmm. cultures pull away mm-hmm. and say, oh yeah, it's palliative care all mm-hmm. the way through in order to make it so that the family can keep their shit together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or that the child isn't as afraid. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't make the word hospice as fearful as it is, mm-hmm. or however we've internalized it mm-hmm. as a culture, maybe we could have different, more open conversations about this.
Yep. And that's what I think is so important about changing the narrative of hospice, because the 6 month, like the people using it currently, like, as an end of life, just simply the last week, they're not getting the full benefit. And then when we touch though on the children with like palliative, the death denial, I think that's, I don't know, like it two separate ideas that I'm going off of. I'm squirreling.
No, squirrel away. We'll get there.
Because it's true though, that it is a death denial. And then it does create, I feel like, kind of further complications, like, because then you're that oh shit moment happens, like, rather, I mean, I can't speak to how they embrace it. I know that they give them support for pediatrics, you know, through that. However, I feel like part of that would be taking that breath and having that conversation. This is actually hospice, not just comfort care.
Do you think there's a point in time that parents are talked to or family caregivers are talked to say, you know, your child's in palliative care, you know, the prognosis is, you know, 2 months, blah, blah, blah. So they're talking and using the term palliative care, but they're actually telling them the details of the fact that actually this is more hospice, but they're not using that word.
So I can't speak to pediatrics, but in my experience in my own hospice, we have had that where patients were unaware that they were on. Family members wanted to keep it hush hush. And then the doctors that prescribed the hospice that we got, then we do the consult. We sit down with the families. We're kind of caught off guard. And then it became kind of like this secret. Like, we're not going to tell this loved one they're on hospice. We're just here to provide services.
Wow.
So even the patient themselves wouldn't know that they're on hospice, which is a strange territory that is to each family its own choice, I guess. But again, when I think of the psychosocial needs that need to be met, that is death avoidant. It's not embracing that we will die.
There's, I think, and I do know, different cultures have different expectations about who's making the decisions in regard to care, right? Certain cultures are like, no, the person who is dying or the person who is sick actually has the right to be involved in all the decision-making about what's going on there. Other cultures are like, no, as a family, that's our responsibility and not the responsibility. So we have to be, as you know, people who are providing services, very, very careful to not say, yeah, what we're doing here, though, is not the right thing to do. But when in their culture, it is the right thing to do. So one of the things that I know bereavement coordinators and other therapists who are involved, even post-loss, they need to be aware that different cultural expectations and that we're not pathologizing that and saying, wow, they did it. They never should have did it that way. That's just not the right thing to do. When that could be coming from the fact in the, you know, American, Italian, you know, background, you know, we're going to talk about everything over and over again, and things are out there, and you know what I mean?
No, I do. That's exactly, like, so I'm thinking back as just you're talking, like, part of our intake process in hospice is finding what the patient's religion is so that we can abide by what their practice is for the end of life. Like, for some cultures, like, opening a window is a big part, and like having the body prepared. And so being aware of that beforehand, and then it gives us even more benefit if, you know, someone is sick, terminally ill, that we can prepare for those, right? Rather than, because there's been instances where people are unprepared and their body is sitting in a crematorium waiting for a pickup from a funeral home. Sorry to be very graphic, but it's true.
And if we're not being graphic, people aren't talking about this
stuff. Even on hospice, will avoid picking a funeral home, even though they're on hospice.
Well, yeah.
So it's again, that like fear of death. So it's our goal to guide them through that, to accept it. And then also the family as well, to meet them where they're at, to help guide them. Like you said, the culture, that's part of like where we're trying to approach and understand so that we can incorporate that into their end of life needs. Because some of them are so specific, like Buddhists, like we had to, it's not as prevalent as, like, I would say the Christian religion around here, right? Like, it's seeking that out. But we have done that to meet the need, like, found a local, you know.
Yeah, somebody who will sit next to the person as they're going through the, like, isn't it, it's like 40 days of, like, there's a whole thing about the whole.
I don't know the whole process, but I know, like, they have gone, like, out of their way to make sure that need is met.
That's huge.
Yeah. So,
because some of them are more elaborate than other ones.
Exactly.
You know, some are, I'm just going to go in there and be able to say goodbye to my loved one and, you know, go with Christ or, you know, go in Christ or whatever. But other ones are like, we're not going to speak about this. So you guys are really jumping through a lot of hoops to make sure that psychosocial care is appropriate for this family.
Yes.
And if you go in there thinking, otherwise are not being aware of that, you could cause harm to the family.
That's what I was just going to say. What's so important about hospice is like being mindful that you're not creating, like being an architect of more trauma mm-hmm. around an already end of life, very sensitive time. And how that's handled can really have an impact on people's grief.
Yeah.
Like when I look back at when I was a bereavement coordinator in COVID, I'm like at one point when it first started and recognizing that we were going to be addressing COVID patients, there was a huge like discrepancy, like families weren't allowed in. Sometimes some of our staff wasn't allowed in. There was a lot of isolation and a lot of, you know, we saw like, so hospice, our goal is to keep you where you want to be, whether it's your nursing home, mm-hmm. your home, whatever it is, to keep you out of the hospital. That's our goal. Like, because at some point, a majority of people reach where I just want to be comfortable. I want to stay home and enjoy the quality of life for the what I have.
Yep.
Rather than continuing to get treatments that can decrease the quality of life. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're trying to meet them at. Now, squirrel, where was I going back before then?
We were talking about meeting families where they were at. Oh, darn it. And I got caught up into listening to what you have to say.
Well, that's part of where we are meeting families where they're at.
Oh, not doing harm. Not doing harm, like, for families, like, you know, during COVID.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So circling back to COVID. So, and that was so traumatic to families in the grieving process. Like, for myself, our nurses, some facilities would allow even our nurses, and families could not. Then eventually we could do window visits. And then I myself had to do a window visit with someone who lost their wife.
Who was in the facility.
Oh my God.
But he wasn't allowed out of the facility to attend her funeral. So they had to do a drive-by and he had to watch through a window screen, his wife's casket. And wasn't able to be at her funeral.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I know. I've ran it. I had a lot of clients actually that had to attend funerals via Zoom. Mm-hmm. And there would be, you know, a religious person there, maybe one other person mm-hmm. who was involved. And then all the people were there via Zoom. They're just lost that ritual.
Exactly. The ritual, mm-hmm. which like complicated, I feel like, the grief for a lot of people, because the end of life, rituals, the things that we do that abide by religion, like, think you're not allowed in to do these rituals mm-hmm. afterwards. You can't. If the body had COVID, you called the coroner. Like, it was a whole, like, against the grain of what our natural process would be to abide by, like, for our culture to give us healing. Yeah. So people were prevented that. When it came to the one individual that I had that wasn't even able to attend his wife's death, like, I did pre-bereavement. Mm-hmm. I was hands-on. I had to do a window visit, like do counseling through a screen of the nursing home. And the best that we could do in the moment was create something of his wife's clothing that he could keep with him. And so he was starting to progress in dementia. And so we had a memory bear made of his wife's clothing, and then he attached that to her, and that's what gave him comfort through the whole situation. Mm-hmm. And, eventually he was put on our services, kept his bear always with him. And I'm just smiling because it warms my heart that we weren't able to give such a small comfort, because he was buried with his wife's bear.
Oh my God. And now I'm going to cry. So thanks. Like,
it's such a privilege to have been a part of that, but like having to adapt to these things, but also bearing witness to how COVID really disrupted like these cultural, anything, our ability to grieve. I really feel like it just added an extra layer of complication to the grieving process, because we weren't able to say those goodbyes.
Right.
Patients weren't, or it was on FaceTime. That's traumatic. Am I?
Oh, I think so too. I mean, there's such a, like, I don't even like doing therapy via telehealth. Mm-hmm. You know, I will, you can do good stuff there, mm-hmm. but there's something about the in-person, and it just, there's an intimacy that you mm-hmm. can't have. I cannot imagine, mm-hmm. you know, being with your loved one in one of the most important transitional times, mm-hmm. you know, and what if your belief system is nothing happens afterwards, that's it. Mm-hmm. You don't get that final goodbye, mm-hmm. you know, if it's hey, I'll see you in heaven. That might land a little bit differently for people. Not that you're not saying goodbye, but, you know, I know I'll be reunited with them when they have a belief system, when that, you know, so all of those things that, you know, they can't engage in.
Carry a lot of guilt.
And then another part of this, and we've been talking about this for like the last day or so, navigating relief and guilt, which I think we'll talk about more when we're talking about, you know, caregiving, because you feel guilty for feeling relieved. And then, so we'll come back to that. Can I, just for people who don't know the process, like how does somebody get on hospice? Like, do they reach out? Does somebody reach out to them? How do we, how do we know?
So how we kind of talked about the children's palliative, sometimes we're fortunate enough, the doctors have the discussion, but they have to make a referral. There has to be a referral made to hospice.
From a doctor.
From a doctor.
Period. So that's where it all starts.
But a family can request a referral.
So they can talk to a doctor and say, please give us hospice. Yes. So if they know enough about it, they can request it. But either way, if they don't know about it, then the doctor is responsible for making that referral.
Yes. And
interesting.
Yes. Okay. And we've had before, you know, like the experience of very bluntly, like people diagnosed with cancer going through treatment and then just basically being told, okay, you're like, your only other option is hospice. And without explaining any of that, like very abrupt. So it's interesting how, not interesting, disgusting, but it's not more handled in a better bedside manner to like approach people, because that in itself is a trauma that then people have to process, because it can come out of left field for them.
Yeah. Like, yeah, we were just in treatment and we had hope. I won't obviously breach confidentiality, but I had a client of mine who's gone like directly through everything you're talking about right now and not given the tools needed in order to know what she was needing to do when she was at home taking care of her loved one who was dying. And I want to be careful and not breach that. But so the doctor makes the referral to the hospice.
So yes. And then we have an intake coordinator who's then going to take things from there, where they're going to sign the consent to allow the Medicare benefit to pay for hospice. So what we cover is hospital beds, like DME equipment, wheelchairs, medications related to the diagnosis, comfort care. Another thing I didn't mention is that we have aides also that are based on the patient's need that are supposed to be an additional layer of support in conjunction with the nurse for physical care. So it's not uncommon.
Like wound care and that kind of thing?
Not wound care, like showering, bathing.
Oh,
like
okay.
The things that day to day, like we don't recognize.
Activities of daily living?
Yes.
Okay.
Our ADL. Okay. Activities.
ADL. Okay. Yes. Gotcha.
Which it's not uncommon when people get signed on that sometimes they get a little bit better with the level of care, because it's more upped, another layer compared to some of the care they may have been getting before.
Yeah.
Because it's so multidisciplinary and faceted. That's why I say it's like shocking our current healthcare system isn't like that. And I think that's why people are so not informed, but why I love this center, because it brings that approach not just to the end of life, but our goal is to have that approach throughout our whole lives. Yeah.
I think it's, you're making a really interesting point, or you at least have said it, and I'm just going to point it out, was, you know, and sometimes the person gets better. And then all of a sudden, everybody around them was like, oh my God, he's coming back. Maybe he's getting better. So then you have the surge of hope. And it isn't necessarily that they're not still terminal, but it's just because the dying process has multiple trajectories. Some dying processes are very jagged. They get better, they get worse, they get better, they get worse. And but you know, ultimately there's like the step down approach. Some people are, you know, sick, and then there's this massive drop very quickly. And then other people kind of have a a level, they drop, but then they go up and they plateau and they'll plateau for a while and maybe go. And it's very confusing because the people around them are like this push pull of, do I get close to you or do I pull away from you? Because that happens when, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to, how am I supposed to look at this? And I don't want to get my hopes up, but look, you're now functioning better. So now I got all these people around this person that, you know, my loved one is being taken care of. And then now they're doing better. And then I wonder if there's guilt because they felt like they weren't doing as good as they should have, quote unquote, should have, shitting all over themselves. So, I don't know. This is very, complicated. Okay. So more people come in, that person starts getting taken care of.
Yes.
Whether it's at home or the hospital or a nursing facility.
So we'll meet them wherever they're at. So we, if someone is discharged, like part of the goal of hospice is to keep people out of the hospital.
Okay.
When people are taken in, like the, if, let's say they fall, you know, they need to go to the ER. We understand that. But the goal is to not be hospitalized because we want them to be where they want to be. The goal is to keep them out of the hospital and provide the treatments
in home
or in wherever they may be in the facility. Then the RN case manager, so the nurse, will go out and do an assessment themselves. And they will evaluate if they think that the patient meets the criteria to come onto hospice. So the criteria would be a 6-month prognosis, but sometimes people live more, some people live less. You know, it's all dependent, like we talked about, the trajectory.
Right.
Things are different for every person. So after that, it's a very intense kind of like 5-day period. I wouldn't say very intense, but you're going to be meeting the whole team. You're going to be meeting the social worker, the aides, you know, the nurses coming in.
All within like 5 days.
Yeah. The spiritual care. I mean, you can deny any of these services, the volunteer, but there's a requirement. We have to come out. We have to show, like, provide the services. You have the right to deny them, but you're going to be introduced to the team. So once we have that in order, what, and their treatment plan in order, after that, the nurse is going to be coming at least once a week, increase based upon need. Aides, same thing. Social worker, same thing. Music therapy, all based on what the patient, family, all need. And then every week we review as a team what's going on with this patient. What can we do to help them, you know, with their end of life needs? Do we need to see, do they need more spiritual care? Do they need pre-bereavement, medications, like anything like that, and how we can help families also navigate this pathway to make it as easy as possible, as difficult as it is. Because as you touched on the anticipatory grief, there is that back and forth. Like sometimes they get better, sometimes then it's up and down. You're kind of feeling guilty, like when are they going to die? Because you're waiting, you're holding your breath.
Well, yeah.
And it's scary. You don't want them to die, but at the same time, you don't want to see them how they are. So helping people unpack that is a big part of where we're at too, and meeting them in navigating all those emotions because it is so complex. And I feel like people feel like it's abnormal to have them, but it's incredibly normal, which later we'll touch on like caregivers and how it affects, you know, you mentally, physically. But our goal in hospice is to help also the caregivers, the families, not reach that burnout point. So encompassing that whole perspective is our goal to help navigate this transition into whatever the transition we have for. I don't know. We don't know the answers yet.
Yeah. What's after? I haven't died yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on over there.
Me neither.
I'm curious, but not too curious.
But you touched on earlier, it's not uncommon where people, like, we could talk all about the dying process of seeing things of the other side, those that have already passed.
Oh, extraordinary experiences. We're going to have a whole podcast on that.
Yeah, that is very common as people are beginning to transition and families will get scared. What is going on? What are they seeing?
Like if they're seeing, you know, dead relatives in the corner of the room or seeing bright lights or an angel or, you know, whatever, you know, they're seeing or the peace sometimes that comes over their face. People will talk about that, like as they were dying, like just all of a sudden they were just like, I'm not scared anymore. I'm okay. And who doesn't want to have a death like that? That's what I mean by a good death.
Good
like,
death. Yeah. Yes.
So, the Oh, because I had questions and then you were talking, so I started listening and then I forgot the question.
You're going to edit a lot of this because you're like a lot of squirreling.
I don't know. They might want to keep all of it. It's kind of funny. The question that I had was, okay, you had said 6 months.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yes. I remember the other one. Number one, you said Medicare.
Yes. Care.
So as long as you are on hospice, you can receive Medicare. Does it depend on the age?
So we've had other insurances that are not Medicare, but it's very rare.
Okay.
Typically, Medicare will step in. So it's kind of like, let's think of it like this. You have a ticket, and this is Medicare, and you're giving hospice your Medicare ticket to pay for all of your end-of-life needs, and we're going to cover everything, and we're not going to bill you.
Right.
We're going to take on everything that you need so that you don't have to worry about it. Medications can be delivered to your house. We're trying to make this as easy as possible so that you can just focus on your loved one. Many people get the caregiver role, as we're touching on, being a caregiver rather than being able to be present as a wife, a child, a parent, you know, getting wrapped up in that role, not being able to be present for the end of life.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.